Welcome to the September 19th, 2023 regular session of the Island County Board of Health. Commissioner Wallen, I believe, had a conflict today. And Captain, Altoff, thank you. I don't know what my deal is with that name. She's not here. She might have had a conflict too. Typically, that's the reason people aren't here. Do we have any changes to the August 15th regular session minutes?
No.
Well, let's make a motion to approve them.
I move. Oh.
Go ahead.
Nope.
Move approval of the Island County Board minutes for August 15th.
Second. Motion by Bob, second by Melanie. Look, we're going to be informal today, apparently. To approve the minutes. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Yeah, it's an aye. Motion carries.
I am a distracted aye.
I just moved for you. You know how I like to vote.
She's going to start voting early and often.
I assume you were abstaining because you weren't here.
No, I just take the vote, Melanie. I assume Mike's going to take it.
Yeah, you can.
At this time, we'll open it up for public input or comments. Just a reminder that public input should be directed to the members of the Board of Health. And we'll try to limit them to about 3 to 5 minutes. Does anybody want to talk to us? That's why we said 5 minutes.
The room was full. It'd been a difference.
We knew the answer. Okay, we'll close the... Oh, anybody online? Doesn't look like it. We'll close the public comment period. And our first item of business is consolidated. Our first item of business is, are there any additions or changes to the agenda?
There is a change. Heather had to be out unexpectedly, so I'll present on
okay.
the solid waste contract.
Okay. Otherwise, let's make a motion to approve the agenda as we could say the agenda just has the topic, so... As presented?
I'll move to approve the agenda as presented.
Second. Motion by Janet, a second by Melanie to approve the agenda as presented. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Now we're ready for the contract.
Yep.
I probably have a, yeah. Now we're ready for the contract. Contract amendment number 15.
So this is an expected amendment with the Washington State Department of Health, amendment number 15 to our consolidated contract, and it revises funding for foundational public health services, the maternal child health block grant, our emergency preparedness funding, and COVID-19 gap funding. So all of this funding, and as well as our women, infants, and children nutrition program, or WIC. So this is all expected funding. Apart from there is new funding within FPHS Foundational Public Health Services, we have new funding focusing on communications, preparedness, community-based prevention, and finance capacity. And so we've previously workshopped this funding with the board, and this is the first time it's coming to the Board of Health. We're looking, so part of this funding is an expansion of last year's allocation of life course funding. Life course funding is intended for maternal child health, chronic disease initiatives, and injury prevention. We've past allocated this to our community outreach worker program, the Senior Falls Coalition, building on chronic disease prevention work. And we're looking at how we can use this funding collaboratively with our human services department and the early childhood work they are engaged in and finding opportunities there. And let's see, the Senior Falls prevention work is continuing. Some of that was contracted out to community partners as part of the Senior Falls Coalition work. And then the WIC funding is expected a little bit decrease from last year's allocation, but we've been able to balance the budget out there and not a significant decrease. And then let's see what else. The maternal child health block grant is expected ongoing funding. Emergency preparedness is new, and we're looking at offsetting costs for some of our supervisors and managers who work within emergency preparedness and oversee that staff, member, the emergency preparedness coordinator. And so we can use this funding to round out the full FTE we have doing public health emergency preparedness. The communications funding is new, and we're looking at a contract. That the goal is to really contract specifically for social media engagement and build on our outreach capacity. You know, we have a staff of scientists primarily, and so having a contractor with that background in social media, and it wouldn't be only to serve public health. We're looking at how this could be a resource across the county, in particular with human services, also though other departments that have a health component of their outreach and messaging, like for the comp plan, there's opportunity there. Public Works, if they're working on a biking map campaign or something like that. And so that's the plan. It also would fund a portion of the county communications manager if the board approves. So I can hold there for any questions. I think we touched on most of the different buckets within this new funding.
Any questions, Rochelle?
Yes. So sort of working backwards, one is clarification. What's an H2A housing entity? Because it was in the contract that you're talking about ensure adequate resources are directed towards H2A housing within fishing industries, long-term care to prevent and control disease transmission. It goes to, I want to talk a little bit about this contract, if I'm on the right page, consolidated contract, and what's happening with COVID response. Do you have any idea what that is, either of you? Okay, it's okay. It's not a big deal. Just that was more of a clarification. It looks to me like high risk, dense kinds of housing or facility locations. But in the contract, it talks about continued management of COVID-19, even though we've moved out of the pandemic phase and into the endemic phase. It has on page 207 some stuff around continued case investigation, all the usual things. Right. What's your anticipation of that in terms of, I'm getting, as it comes into fall and we see some case rates going up and the data that we've discussed, and then the new news of other things. What's your sense of how active we're going to be in this part of the contract?
Yeah, so this gap funding is there to maintain the existing capacity we have. We have a COVID epidemiologist. We have outreach capacity built into our program and vaccine coordination. But we are seeing a number of changes, you know, with commercialization of the vaccine, and our COVID supervisor will speak to that towards the end of the meeting today. Yeah. But, you know, right now, the uptick in cases, staff are certainly engaged with, really the focus right now is our liaison services and how we're connecting with long-term care, schools, and child care facilities, other community partners like food banks, and getting information tests out into the community, continuing to provide that liaison support. But I don't fully anticipate drawing down all of this funding. It's a little generous, but it will cover the capacities we have in place. And is there's room if we were to see a large case acceleration, but it's essentially continuing the level of service we have at this point.
I think I'll save some of my questions for later because, you know, I'm getting a lot of public questions about some of this stuff, and I think that's the right time for it. You said we got a little bit less money at WIC. Is that a formulaic thing? Do we have less kids needing WIC services, or was that a budget thing?
You know, during the pandemic, there were waivers in place. So if we had a change in caseload, you know, we didn't have an impact to our funding. And with the end of the emergency period, some of those waivers have since been discontinued. So it's really reflective of our current, the number of families we're serving. And it wasn't a significant drop. It was around, I think, $20,000 to $30,000. But we also have some other, like, Medicaid match that if we need to extend services, we can. But so not a significant decline. And we continue to promote WIC out in the community.
Okay, thanks.
Now, that's a pretty significant decline. I mean,
when you're talking about
babies. Well, if you're talking about how you're paying for an employee. right?
Right.
It's probably half of an employee, maybe a little less than half. So,
yeah.
So that's not totally little. So we need to watch it so it doesn't keep declining.
Yeah.
But when you say it's based on current utilization, it's based on past utilization. So it's like a quarter or two delayed, right?
A delay.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I think that we'll catch ourselves back up to full utilization as other stabilization funding sources go away in the community, right? That families maybe didn't seek WIC benefits when they were getting child tax credits and different things that allowed them to kind of function. And then as those benefits go away, they're going to realize like, oh, wait, that these eggs cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad we have, I'm a big supporter of the program.
Yeah.
Well, one reason we're not feeling it so much is because the board supported us to develop our own breastfeeding peer counselor position. And so that added capacity. And so we had a very part-time WIC certifier position where the employee moved on, and we've decided not to refill with that breastfeeding peer counselor position in place in our other staffing. But it's something we'll keep a close eye on.
Now, does approving this contract mean that we're approving all the proposed positions that you just talked about, or it just means we're approving taking the money?
Yeah, just approving taking the money. There's lots of room for policy discussion. We'll go in kind of a deeper dive to the FPHS in the FPHS presentation.
Okay.
Yep.
Are there any other questions about contract number 15, contract amendment number 15?
Would you like a motion?
I sure would.
So I'll make a motion to approve consolidated contract amendment number 15 with Washington State Department of Health.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second to approve consolidated contract amendment number 15 for the underlying contract presented. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Solid Waste Management Local Waste Financial Assistance Agreement.
Yes, so contract number 2. This is with the Washington State Department of Ecology to provide funding for our solid waste enforcement response through June 30th of 2025, as well as, and this comes through the Model Toxics Control Operating Account. It's an amount of around $180,000, and the work we do, there's a regulatory component. There's also a component where we're licensing and inspecting solid waste facilities in the county and providing technical assistance on waste disposal, and as well as responding to complaints or regulatory concerns around storage and accumulation of waste. So we have a staff member that delivers this program. And let's see, this is expected funding. I'll turn it over for board questions if there are any specific questions related to this work.
We have any questions related to the solid waste management financial assistance agreement?
Are these dollars paying for an employee? Are these dollars paying for something new? Or what are these dollars paying for?
They cover an existing employee. They do cover some costs related to cleanup, but that's not the majority amount. And it's our cost to administer the program.
So you mentioned around 180. I'm looking at 194,448.
That's true. Okay. Thank you for correcting. So the total eligible cost is 194. And there was, an increase this year.
The homeless encampment response money.
Yes.
So that we were trying not to talk about.
Yeah.
way to go there, Mayor. Call it out. Yeah. So there was an additional $14,000 for that.
Yes.
I just happened to be on the right page. I'm not that smart. I literally was on the right page for that question.
Thank you.
Which is insufficient for what we do. We do the response.
The drop in the pond, we do provide some level of support.
So I'll move approval of Solid Waste Management Local Solid Waste Financial Assistance Agreement. with the Washington Department of Ecology contract number as printed.
Thanks. Second. Motion by Bob, second by Melanie to approve solid waste management local solid waste financial assistance agreement with the Washington State Department of Ecology for the underlying contract. Wait, I feel like there needed to be a for the underlying contract. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries unanimous. Then we have Memorandum of Understanding between North Sound Accountable Community of Health and Island County Public Health for the development of a mobile outreach service van.
A van, yes.
Like, why aren't they saying van? Oh, I know.
Yeah. The mobile services van. So this is a project proposal that was developed by Public Health and Human Services around developing mobile service delivery. We worked with community partners to look at how we can extend the reach of existing services. So this project is not about adding new services to our scope, but looking at the work our teams are already engaged in and how we can support staff by providing a safe environment for service delivery out in the community. And there are risk considerations for the board to think through as we look at this funding. But the goal is to integrate our service delivery, focus on community-based prevention, and reach historically underserved populations. These are some of our partners that were involved in developing the proposal. Opportunity Council, Spin Cafe, Island Senior Resources, and then a variety of healthcare providers who had given feedback around need for existing community-based approaches. The funding comes from North Sound ACH, around $193,000. It's really project funding to purchase probably a Ford Transit vehicle and build out the units. And there's some pictures at the end. The ongoing costs from our motor pool is around $4,300 per year that could be paid through FPHS life course funding. And then staff time, you know, no additional time for staff, but there will be additional work as far as scheduling and coordinating if this is to move forward. So why mobile services? What's the need for this? We have some different data points, different ways we've engaged with the community. There was a provider survey that the health department worked on getting out into the community in 2022 that identified areas of concern. You know, we saw areas of concern around mental health, food security, parenting support, heart disease and diabetes, chronic diseases. And then we asked our community partners which community-based interventions might be helpful and heard a lot about community-based lifestyle interventions or education. Community-based outreach workers providing care linkages and prevention resources, and community-based mental health, which Human Services currently provides. And then we asked about delivery, how could we get information out? And a lot of it was around in-person education, sharing evidence-based print materials. There's an alignment with our CHIP, our Community Health Improvement Plan, the Vision 2020. There's a goal around access to care, around developing a health outreach model that's based on community outreach workers and increasing care access and availability of services and working specifically to reduce barriers for populations at greatest risk. And then really focusing on better coordination of behavioral complementary health strategies, clinical strategies, and then working through on access to care navigation as an approach to addressing depression and suicide. So the approach is really around this concept of community-based disease prevention, something that falls within the scope of public health. It's an evidence-based way to prevent chronic diseases and improve health outcomes. We've been working on strengthening our approaches. This is not an area where historically there's been strong funding to support. We've had funding to look more at an assessment level, kind of what's happening out in the community as far as chronic diseases like heart disease and diabetes. But as far as kind of boots on the ground out there doing education and outreach, that's something we're building on. The goal is to include prevention resources, increase access to community-based behavioral health, and improving rates of preventive screenings like there are a number of recommendations around colorectal cancer screenings or, you know, getting annual blood work to screen for hyperlipidemia. But if we can help folks get connected to care and to providers so that folks can keep up with those preventive health screenings. And we've been looking at resources where we can pull prevention materials from that are already developed and that are evidence-based. And so some of those are shared here. But within our scope, what we're really focusing on, it's educational. You know, we're not providing primary care. We're sharing resources and making the linkages with primary care and working collaboratively with primary care to do this community-based prevention work. And so the goal is to develop culturally responsive prevention resources and make these referrals in both English and Spanish language. Some of the risks, though, to consider as we think about this new service delivery model is, you know, there will be a need for staff coordination across human services and public health. There's lone worker safety concerns, which we currently navigate with our home-based workers, our nurses that are going out into the homes, our outreach workers and mental health providers. So we do have procedures in place and extensive staff training. What we think this can help with is having shared visits so people aren't in the van alone. And we'd work really closely with our health officer to develop procedures and processes that help keep our workers safe, because that's the number one priority. And it's a strong focus of our home-based programs currently. There's infectious disease safety concerns. You know, if we have someone with COVID or another respiratory virus coming in the van and coughing. So it's going to be really important to have clear processes and work with staff to screen for respiratory infection, use proper PPE, and make sure staff are really empowered that if they don't feel comfortable, they can say no. You know, they can say no to a visit. There's no repercussion for that. And also we want to make sure our community understands that this is about community-based supportive education, referrals, and prevention. It's not about delivering primary care to the community. So this is a concept of what it might look like. There are a few regional examples of this. San Juan County recently launched one as part of their public health and human services, and Skagit County. I think this might be San Juan's or Skagit's. And we talked about some of the potential benefits, but when we're looking at these evidence-based interventions, we really want to try to overcome transportation and geographical barriers. And the goal is really just to reach folks, that we can get to people where they are and make it convenient, be flexible and adapt to community needs. And also to support staff safety. We think it's a net gain for staff safety as far as having a HIPAA-compliant dedicated space. It'll be easy to disinfect and store supplies. We can do shared visits more easily, but we also really need to focus on the procedures part of this to make sure it's safe. And of course, we're always looking for strategies to better integrate with our partners in human services. So let's see. So this, and as we develop this, I created a logic model, which is a public health evaluation tool where we can develop metrics, try to understand, develop an approach so we can understand if this is effective. What we really want to accomplish with this project is extending reach, in particular to low-income populations, people experiencing homelessness or food insecurity or have language barriers. To work more directly with immigrant communities. We also want to look at long-term metrics. So really the long-term outcome goal is, you know, decreased emergency department visits. If we're getting people better connected to services, providing that community-based prevention, we'd like to see rates of chronic disease improve. I mean, so these are loftier, harder to move the needle on goals, but we think with sustained efforts, it's possible to move the needle and improve rates of access to care for well child and adult annual exams and access to those preventive screenings like colorectal cancer screenings.
Through your recommendations.
to go get the screen.
Right, exactly. Not providing the screenings. But yeah.
On the moving the needle on the long-term metrics, are you going to be measuring the, as you interact with folks, right, as we serve them and you are able to make a recommendation to go in and do a preventative care visit, to do a screening, you'll be able to document that within our captive population in the sense that the folks that we serve, we can track those metrics. How closely, this is a challenge that I feel like we all have in the field, how closely will our success rates with our served population be indicative of the population health metrics for our county around increased prevention? People have a primary care provider, people have enrolled in healthcare access, what, you know, the typical things. What's your sense of, with our, what we're doing here, will we be able to do both? And what's your sense of the relationship as we track these outcomes? Because I'm certainly going to be grateful to see our own folks that are engaged in treatment, in services, do better, but there's a tension between, can we actually measure it on a population health level and really know whether we're capturing enough information?
Yeah, that gets really tricky. And I'll work closely with our assessment supervisor and the team to kind of try to develop metrics that we can understand trends and see our impact. But I think if I understand your question, so, you know, this is one piece of the puzzle, and there's a number of other contributing factors. You know, we talk a lot about the social drivers of health and, you know, access to housing, access to affordable food. And so there's lots of other community-based factors that play into these chronic disease outcomes. So it'll be something we'll look at in that context. And fortunately, we have staff that are have strong skill set in looking at that data, but it'll be a somewhat of a puzzle. But
I'm sort of wondering if we know we want to target the high utilizer population, right? If you will be directly working with the ER department at would be health, for example, it'd be nice if Ron was here to say, hey, we're here. If you know where some of your more high risk, high utilizer population is, we're happy to go out and engage in our folks coming out of the jails, making sure that we've engaged them in the, you know, as you're working with Chelsea on services and that transitional population, that we make sure we know of those high risk, high utilizer folks as soon as we can, because they're the ones who are most likely to be having real significant issues and lack of those social supports that are so indicative. I'm supportive of this. You already know that, but I do want to make sure we engage with our most high risk folks with this service.
Now, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
As you were talking, it made me think of something. Do you think that the purpose is to engage with our high utilizer population, or could a purpose be to engage with populations that aren't high utilizers of services, but actually underutilizers, so that especially as preventative disease, right, we're not talking to them at all.
Yeah.
So high utilizers, we know them, we're talking to them, we're engaging with them. They typically, we try to get them a behavioral health support. They can get themselves to the ER probably too frequently. But then as you were saying that, I was like, well, that's the same population. What about these people we're not
talking to? I call them the emerging risk population, and I totally agree with that question.
So I don't know from like a policy standpoint of like who really our audience should be. Should it be mm-hmm. to reach out to people who we know need services and pull them into a system? Or should it be to stabilize those individuals who are high utilizers of the system?
I will say when we're envisioning this project, it fell a little bit more into that second category. We're thinking about folks out in our rural communities where we can
not engaging.
Yeah. And actually somewhat urban, like could we bring this to Walmart, you know, and work in the parking? I know there's been past partnerships there. So folks who maybe haven't been as, we haven't reached as much in the past. But I know Human Services has been very proactive around, again, engaging with the population that we're reaching with emergency departments and the jails. So probably some mixture of both.
Commissioner Johnson asked a good question, because if we can capture that moderate risk or emerging risk, or they're on, you know, earlier, they don't become one of those high risk, high utilizers.
Yeah.
So I appreciate the question, because I have the same. Yeah. You save more money with the high risk, high utilizers by doing, you brought it up for me because you raised the population health metrics as part of how you're going to do this. That's how it came to me.
Yeah.
But, and you save more money on hitting those real high utilizers. But I concur from a policy perspective. In some ways, I want to say what Commissioner Johnson is asking is something I think helps people from falling off the cliff.
Yeah, really look upstream.
I'd like to talk or ask a question about reaching people with language barriers. A couple things. One, do you have staff who speak Spanish or Tagalog?
Well, not Tagalog. We have one staff member within public health who has been certified as an interpreter and is a community outreach worker. She currently does provide some level of outreach support in Spanish language, and that has helped us build bridges and build trust. We want to make sure that that work is, you know, that we're appropriately supporting her for that level of service. But that is the plan, to provide Spanish language services, because we do have a significant community that's Spanish only. And of course, we do have the language access line, and expanding into Tagalog and would be a longer term goal. Yeah.
You mentioned that you're going to have your forms available in Spanish. And I can't remember, I was talking to Michael Jones or to Kevin, I don't remember, but they've had very few people have reached out and said, we need these different forms translated. Are you going to use those county providers to translate, or do you have some other providers to translate the documents?
So a lot of these prevention resources we're sharing, I can back up here a bit. So we have resources, I skipped it, from MyPlate, University of Arizona.
They're already translated.
Yeah, they're all translated. The Old Ways Nutrition nonprofit. So we're looking at tools where they come in different languages mm-hmm. already. So actually we could probably access resources in Tagalog. But then it's the staff capacity piece.
What about that? We had a conversation at a round table, I think recently, about the technology that translates, so you can put it at a counter. Would that type of technology work in the van?
It would be a great step. It would get us in that direction.
That phone that does it.
That's a great idea.
Nailing it with the question. No, I don't have any answers.
We go to the lone worker safety protocols. I know we already have outreach workers and home-based workers and early childhood interventions, but can you just it doesn't stop me. I worried about it when I was overseeing programs and I was thinking about it after you presented. Are there standards that are by, I don't know, either human, that we'll make sure we have? And I remember when I had to make a policy to require our workers who are doing home-based services or outreach always to have a cell phone. It's the one piece of any of our work where we're sending folks out into the field that always makes me a little bit nervous, not this program specifically, but any of them. So I just want to make sure that you're working with HR and that we have clear safety standards. They're never totally isolated. They always have some way to communicate and carry some kind of, it's something it has always made me nervous for 30 years to be sending people into the field. So
yeah, I share that concern. The risk group has been a really great partner in reviewing procedures we've developed, and Susan's team. So we have Oregon Health Authority has been really proactive on their approach to home safety, and DOH has some great resources too, but the Oregon Health Authority, it's very robust. And so we've actually pulled their resources to develop our staff protocols. They have a series of videos we have all nurse visitors train with, and then a procedure manual, but it also has a form assessment. So when you arrive on site, you complete this form. We're using the technology tool that we're incorporating that Linda shared was a Life 360. So folks can turn it on when they're going out to a visit, and it shows the location. There's, you know, distress features, but we would really like to get to all shared visits. And that's a goal we have.
I concur with that.
Bob, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I noticed a van in the parking lot when I was coming in that looks kind of like this van.
Yeah.
You haven't bought the van for this yet, right?
That's very similar, though. I think it might even be a Transit. But the goal, the one we're looking at, there's ones that you can stand up in and have the height and dimensions.
So is that a 21-foot? Do you happen to know the length of?
I have it in an email somewhere. I talked with our facilities.
I assume it doesn't require a CDL commercial.
It does not.
Yeah.
It does not.
Okay. And you're going to park that at Walmart? So whatever.
Well, we would love to work with the city of Oak Harbor and think about service locations and develop a collaborative approach. So
sure.
You can follow up with your team.
So you'll plan to have this van. Who'll be driving it? I mean,
it would be staff. So, you know, our outreach workers or community-based mental health providers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then finally, you're going to Camino, South Whidbey, obviously full county-wide service.
Definitely. So the service locations, probably the Camino Center would be, we talked a bit with the community center there, the community center down on South Whidbey. Maybe the Good Cheer Food Bank. We've had some conversations with them. So, yes.
What are we doing with the old van?
So the van within Human Services, we looked at that option. The issue, is that the van you're referring to?
Don't you have a public health van that's colorful? We got rid of that van.
That one's long gone. Yeah. brings up,
At least that eliminates one of my, what are we doing with that?
Concern. Yeah.
We are not. We disposed of it. I've been here a little long, I think.
I think saw some photos, though. That actually brings up, though, the plan is a simple logo, and we're open to any suggestions for naming from the board or art. Feel free to reach out.
The name is the thing that pushed it over the edge.
Which is called Van. It's a good name.
I don't. Someone in the community suggests the wellness wagon. So I'll float that possibility.
That just takes me back to my childhood of the welcome wagon. Now you all know how old I am.
Can I ask a question about programs that we deliver from our Family Resource Center?
Yes.
So would we replicate those programs in the van? So I'm thinking about our needle exchange program. Maybe what's involved in family planning conversations and distribution. Are we planning to do needle exchange within the van? Are we planning on doing distribution of products from the van?
At this point, we haven't landed on doing needle exchange within the van, and we'll work through some of that and talk with our health officer and, you know, with Human Services around safety components of that. Really, the plan on some of the home-based supportive nursing work, the family outreach work, that some of it does take place in our resource center. A lot of it is field-based. So we wouldn't be, it would give staff that other location to do the work within. Though there was recently the HEPA air filter distribution. So products like that, I could see distributing.
No one's going to yell at me about air filters, so I was less worried about them. I actually support those programs and activities. So I'm not concerned about it. I do want to know if we start doing needle exchange within the mobile van, if we start handing out family planning prophylactics from the van. Again, I'm supportive of preventing unwanted children and supportive of not having communicable disease spread. I just need to know if those activities are moving throughout the community, because right now I've got populations contained and the fact that it happens in certain areas and right. cannot contaminate their children in any way. So as we move around, I just need to know so I'm prepared. That's really all I'm, as you were talking, I was like, oh God, my contained population may break out.
Yeah.
And I need to know.
We will keep the board informed of any changing plans.
Okay. In that regard. I have a request, and it had to be when you were, and it comes from you were talking about sites where you're going to be doing outreach at Goodrich Cheer or whatever. A lot of our moderate risk and high risk folks are transit dependent. I would ask you to reach out to Island Transit and talk with them about the possibility of being at one of our transit center stops, like Terry's Corner down on the South End. If that is an, I'm asking the question, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm saying if that is an appropriate place to be. So I'm not, I would ask them that, and I would ask you guys to talk amongst yourself. I just know that where we know, even we had folks in some of the transit stops that you guys did some emergency interventions with during the pandemic out at the transit stop. So just, I'm asking the question.
Makes sense. I'll follow up with Todd Morrow on that.
Well, based on all the questions you've had, it's all about utilization of the van, which sounds like there's a support to get the van if what we're focused on is how you're going to use it. So this is whether or not we should buy the van, right?
That's correct.
It sounds like, considering the fact that we're managing the programs within it, that we're buying the van. So I would entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve the Memorandum of Understanding between North Sound Accountable Community of Health and Island County Public Health for the development of mobile outreach services.
Second. We have a motion and a second to approve the Memorandum of Understanding between North Sound Accountable Community of Health and Island County Public Health for the development of mobile outreach services. Is there any further discussion? We talked at the regular board again about the safety protocols. I think we're all very focused on that. And the one thing you said that I just really want to reiterate is you said that if someone feels unsafe going into a situation that they can say no. And I really think you can put any policy in the world on paper, but that freedom to give people to trust their gut and walk away from a situation that they feel unsafe is going to be our greatest safety protocol. So I appreciate you saying that. And I just wanted to back up those words. I think the full, at least our full board, and I'm sure Bob too, wants to back up those words to as we do more outreach, trust your instincts on who you're dealing with.
Yep.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. We're getting a van.
Exciting.
I know you Thank clappers you. In the back.
I'm excited about this, actually.
Bob, I'm excited.
I am. Yeah.
Got you.
That's what enthusiasm looks like.
Is that what Alc Harbor enthusiasm looks like?
There'd be an annual parade in Alc Harbor Day.
I might need a Board of Health ribbon cutting.
Go.
The mayor will be there.
Yes.
Okay. This was an innovative solution. Good job.
Thank you.
Now we're going to go into the big presentation on foundational public health services.
Yes, and I apologize. It's scared me a lot today, but there was a request a few sessions back around learning a bit more around how this FPHS funding is supporting different public health programs. So this presentation gives a high-level overview, I think really to get at a detailed level, having program-specific presentations come back to the board. Would be the way to go, but this can provide a kind of a high level. And there's some similarities with the presentation last year around kind of that broad overview of FPHS. So, but for folks who are new to FPHS, it's a statewide set of core public health services, and it's really meant to fund services that the government is responsible for providing across the board in every community. And The goal is to provide revenue streams that are predictable, reliable, and sustainable in response to changes in demand and cost over time. So we talk a lot in the board around, you know, social determinants of health. I've gotten in the habit of calling them social drivers, you know, thinking that they're factors, but they don't fully thing. But social drivers of health, things like education access, economic opportunity, the community context we live in, neighborhood and the built environment, and food access, and the healthcare access and quality in our communities.
On that last one, I wonder, I feel like the Commissioner Johnson raised a really interesting point this morning during Commissioner comments about our economic development survey and the request to have it consider social drivers. And it's not really a two-way street. The economic stability of a community impacts the health of a community, but do the social drivers of health impact the economic health of a community? She raised a good question, and may not be ready to answer it now, but I think it's a question we're trying to figure out how they fit together. Is that fair?
I think that made me sound smarter than I was, so I'll take it.
To think about how economic opportunity impacts the health outcomes and of a community, I think.
Well, we know that to be true from research. What I don't know to be true is, do the health outcomes of a community or the social issues in a community determine the economic strength and resilience of a community? I don't have that research in my head. That's the question I'm asking based on what Commissioner Johnson was asking this morning.
I think mentioning what comes to mind is, you know, the county rankings that take place every year. And I think about when Island County ranks fourth, or maybe it was fifth this year, but there's that ranking that shows the health and well-being of our community and the community investment that takes place in supporting our community members to live full and productive lives, how that translates maybe to desire to move to those communities and invest in those communities. And I don't know if that touches on what you're...
I don't know that I expected an answer so much as it just gets me thinking about whether there's a bilateral relationship to that, or it moves in one direction, or does it move in both directions?
Sure.
I don't expect an answer. She had me thinking about that after this morning, and then you raise it here. So I'm tying the two together for better or worse.
Yeah.
It's not meant to be a marital metaphor.
So, but with FPHS, we are looking at this kind of what we call public health 3.0. In the past, public health, we had a lot of growth in the 1900s. There was a lot of focus on provision of direct services and systematic development of public health, governmental agencies and capacity, but somewhat of an uneven application of public health services. When we think of public health 3.0, we think about this focus on working collaboratively and in across sectors to improve social drivers of health and engage different community members and partners for collective impact.
So as we do work as the county, shifting a different hat here for a second, but as the county does our comprehensive plan, Sean, you will be bringing that into public health contributions to the comp plan?
Yeah, public health, our team is working really closely with long-range planning and the planning team to think about applying this lens to our comp plan process. And it touches on a lot of different health, you know, both community and environmental health topics.
You know, public health is one of our program areas that's delivered interjurisdictionally.
Right.
And all the municipalities are doing comprehensive plans. Well, Coopville did theirs, but they're going to reopen it. They just don't know it yet. So all the jurisdictions are doing comprehensive plans. So that feedback that you're talking about foundational public health, the expectations, what makes the, you know, some of those social, what was, you didn't say determinants, you
said drivers,
social drivers of health. Those value sets need to be delivered interjurisdictionally, and it might be good doing some outreach so that each jurisdiction is also using that kind of health and all policy lens.
Yep.
Because our populations we're really targeting that don't have the same, that are impacted by less access to some of these drivers. Those are in some of the jurisdictions more than they're even in the county.
Yes.
So I think it'd be helpful just to share the lens.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Don't you agree, Mayor?
I'm not sure, but I think I do.
Yeah.
I will say we had our assessment supervisor and I met with Oak Harbor leadership recently, and we talked about the CHA process that we're going through and the comp planning a bit, but more of the CHA, and also talked about, you know, just sharing that we're available to mm-hmm. provide support and collaborate as you all get underway with your comprehensive planning in a collaborative way. Yeah.
I mean, all the jurisdictions are doing it.
Yeah. So that slide had shown that really FPHS is supporting us across the range of public health services, and we'll take a look. But this is, and I think part of, you know, the goal as we strengthen community-based services, that working at the community level promotes healthy living, helps prevent diseases, and brings the greatest health benefits to the greatest number of people in need. So that's our lofty quote. So how do we determine which programs are invested in, you know, the program direction we take? And, you know, it's our Board of Health, it's our local policymakers, our elected officials, and that interaction between our staff and our policymakers. And we also, you know, our staff are looking at data and to guide service delivery. And we do, you know, we also look at state and federal funding. They often come with statements of work, but staff are often involved in helping define some of those through subject matter expert groups and steering committees. Those groups do involve local participation. So before it comes through the consolidated contract, I've participated quite a bit in the Communicable Disease Committee, but there's committees for every category of FPHS and engagement across the state. And a lot of our services, you know, we want to think about interactions across different scales of impact. So thinking about not just that individual level health, but in public health, we want to think more broadly also about our community, you know, the family level and societal levels. You know, we think of health and well-being as influenced by different culture, different environments and contexts, and the same environment can have different effects on the health of people in different ways. So we try to, you know, consider complexity as we develop programs and deliver services. And I'll go through this just really quickly. So when for example, with our WIC program, we think about that individual nutritional support, providing vouchers and education, but also those interpersonal relationships. Are there neighborhood garden opportunities? Are stores offering WIC products? Is it readily available? Do we need to build relationships with grocery store owners in that community? Do convenience stores offer fresh fruits and vegetables so folks can use their WIC vouchers there? So, and then as at a societal level, as we're engaging with our Board of Health and we're thinking about policy making, how can we have impact at that higher level? So it's a bit more of a demanding approach, but it's much more effective to think across these different scales of impact.
I love the non-stigmatizing thing I see in almost every grocery store I've been to in the county, where they have a little fruit stand and they say free fruit for kids. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. There's no qualifying. There's no show me your little card or your food stamps or any of that stuff that used to stigmatize that kind of assistance.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. I think that's a good policy level to think about how program implementation may or may not be stigmatizing, or how we can make it inclusive. It's a great example. So some of the work that's funded from FPHS for our assessment team, it really funds a lot of the CHA CHIP process. So that community health assessment work that our team is working on, we get funding to also support San Juan County's efforts. And I know you're all familiar with the CHA, so I won't dwell on this. This is a timeline that we'll bring back to, you know, probably early in the new year to take stock of where we are in the CHA and provide a more detailed Board of Health update. We have funding, this life course funding for maternal child health, and right now it's funding community outreach workers. It's supporting the new baby, new family, that supportive nursing care for families. And there is some direct services, but also community-based coalitions like Partners for Young Children, and working collaboratively to develop the Help Me Grow Within Reach directory that has come through the Board of Health. A lot of that work was funded through FPHS. And this is the funding we're looking at. How can we be more collaborative with human services work in the early childhood realm? That really there's so much, we work in partnership as far as our teams, but how can we link that funding to be more partnered in that work?
Life course equals maternal childhood support, or
that's a typo.
I'm asking because when we talk about it, we talk about early childhood. I want to make sure that I'm understanding the full definition of life course. Is it to get their life started and on course? That's why they say it, or is it the full course of a life?
Yeah, right. Great question. It's the full course of a life. So when it's the term they use to think about maternal child health, injury prevention, chronic disease prevention, and then the other category is care linkages.
So then I might have a question on that program. I mean, I'm obviously very supportive of expansion in that early childhood area, but we also, based on the age of our county and some of the experiences that 911 is having, and I'd be interested to understand what our program investment is on the latter end of the life course as well, right? So we have, Meals on Wheels. We have that falls prevention work, obviously, is very important. That type of outreach work to that senior population as well.
Yeah, that's a great policy discussion too, because in the county, because of the size of our population. So a lot of counties, this is prescriptive, like you will spend this third on maternal child health, this third on injury prevention. We have some flexibility and we can look at the needs in our community. And that's where, so I'll share, I'm going to skip one slide on the front, we'll go back to it. But so a big chunk of this is funding the Senior Falls Coalition work. And there's room to keep looking at data and readjusting and having that continued conversation with the board on where we're making these investments and how do we want to shift to, and so I think that's a really worthwhile conversation. A lot of this is new work for us. So we stood up this coalition model that a lot of other counties have tried with success and is an evidence-based approach. And so we developed the Senior Falls Coalition and bringing together different stakeholders. And essentially we're sharing resources, bringing folks together, and we're sharing a portion of the life course funding as well with these agencies, but trying to expand the reach of classes, like upstream approaches to help prevent falls. So hopefully we can see the ED visits go down.
Can you bring to us sometime in the future a report on how we're reaching folks and where they're from? So, what's our uptake on services in Oak Harbor on early, the early childhood stuff, or, just a more maybe zip code driven report on how we're developing these services and how we're making sure that they're getting well utilized across the county.
Yeah. And that we can certainly work on that. And I think we could capture that too with like this type of coalition work, because we can look at new courses that were stood up like by the Center on Camino and how many folks are showing up to those. And as part of the contracts with this work or agreements, there's a data sharing component. So we can work on bringing that back.
Yeah, they're growing old together, whatever that program is called, is selling out now.
Okay.
Growing old together.
They have an aging program where they teach all kinds of information about aging from falls prevention to safe homes to connecting to resources to caregiver. It's just it's a multi-week program, and it's not through Island Senior Resources, but it's how to grow old well. They have a really good title for it that I'm going to get yelled at later because I can't remember what it is.
So I'm really interested in this topic. And I just think about this as we're looking through the social ecological model, and you have the maternal child health, but it really is about multi-generational families and the kind of support that is or is not provided to multi-generational families. So I was in California recently. My father's 92. He still lives in his home. My sister, who's a working attorney, lives there to make sure he's taking his pills and so on. We also, my mother has dementia. She's in a little nursing home. My poor sister also. And so we're trying to figure, can we bring mom home? Can we, what can we do? My poor sister also has her own child and her grandchildren that she helps financially support. The burden on her is just extraordinary. And so I call San Bernardino County. Of course, I go to the county.
Right. Yeah.
Go to the county. What kind of services can you help? And they couldn't help because my mom's not on Medi-Cal. So I'm really interested in that as a topic. We have that all over. People are living longer. You have these sandwich generations who are having to take care of their grandchildren and take care of their own parents. And I think from a public health perspective, it's a big issue, Sean.
Yeah, no, I thank you for raising that. And I think that's where, while the intention of FPHS is to really work at the population scale in our rural communities and our urban communities, we see a need for a level of individualized support. I know ISR typically, you know, takes that lead role for our older adult communities, or has some, I believe, contracting in place for that piece. But that's where we've seen the need with our maternal child health communities and with the chronic disease work, which, you know, is tied into the discussion earlier on mobile services. But we'll keep workshopping that with the team. And that's a really important topic to consider the multi-generational families and how we're delivering services.
So it's less than articulate. It's called the Aging Mastery Program, and it's a copyrighted program. The idea of decreasing social isolation, whether you're a young mother with a high needs baby or you're on the older stage of life and your closest child lives 5 hours away, all of that decrease of social isolation, skill building, is sort of what I think about when you talk about FPHS and life coursework.
Those types of community interventions. We've been focused a lot on the STEADY initiative, which is a balanced training toolkit that providers can help implement. And those types of community-based interventions are a great use of FPHS. There's also a role, I think, for provider outreach and education. We brought through the board the provider resources website, but at a community level, also thinking about, as we have new providers come through, new nurses, new school nurses, like, can we, you know, do that outreach? So we're sharing about maternal child health resources in the county, sharing about communicable disease and notifiable conditions. I have a goal, and I'd be interested in the board's feedback on even thinking about kind of webinars or continuing education type offerings, so providers can get that education locally and have it be locally relevant, and working in partnership with other agencies to deliver that. But that's something FPHS can support too, that we haven't explored before.
Does FPHS and Life Course stuff support some of the things that we're seeing? And I think you were partnering with Pierce at some point, but like the Live Well stuff, whether it's access to different information. I hate directories because the minute they're published, they're out of date. But how do you were talking about access to information and all of this stuff and that whole Live Well model. I don't know how much it's happening in our area.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with the Live Well model. I mean, we invested a lot in the Help Me Grow because that nonprofit can maintain it, so it's accurate and current. And we've also, though, developed the provider resources is essentially a provider directory for information. And then on our website, we do share resources for providers and families that goes beyond just the early childhood phase to make sure there's resources available beyond what Help Me Grow offers as well.
I know you're trying to talk about foundational public health, but you know, now we're talking, I have to brainstorm 10,000 things we could do and I can't help myself. So do you want me to brainstorm now, or do you want me to just keep writing them down and brainstorm later? Because I mean, I'm on channel 10 over here in Oak Harbor. I've got a marketing campaign to roll out. I mean, I've got nothing but ideas now. How do you want me to manage those? Do you
want me to? I mean, we can dive in.
Or hold them.
I got my pen ready, so if you'd like to dive in.
Well, I mean, I'm one of those conversations. As I'm thinking about just community education outreach, and then you have that communication position.
That's right.
And then Bob's got a TV station. He's got a TV over there. I mean, I'm wondering if I get these. For early childhood, I get these texts. I don't know where they come from. I think they come from Head Start.
Yeah.
And I get them like every couple of days, and it says, have this conversation with your kid at the dinner table. When you're in the grocery store, is this the...
I think it's Bright by Text.
It's brilliant. It's whatever great. It is, it's yeah. brilliant. I yeah. literally am like, oh, that's brilliant. It's, I mean,
rumors.
They're
cool.
And they're positive things, and they're simple things, and they're little things, and they're... But, what I was thinking is that a lot of these things that just accumulate conversation stimulation, getting people to think about things, most people are able to solve their own problems. You just don't think about 90% of them that are coming at you, right? But it'd be great if there was a way to take like those early childhood tips they already exist and turn them into like a slide that goes on Channel 10 that just asks the community a question. At the dinner table, ask your child what their favorite thing was about the day. Ask them what they liked the least. They will tell you that you did not play with them enough every day. So, but there are fun things that they do. I think for seniors too, have you looked around and figured out where you take some of those slip and fall tips that are out there and just start placing them in the community as part of the life course. And even that like sandwich generation, I mean, I think it's important as a community, we acknowledge what that is, right? That if you are experiencing aging parents and screaming children, here's a tip, walk away, right? I mean, sometimes it's just walk away. You got to just go for a walk. I don't know. I was just like, I wrote down some of these things. It's like, look, we have some leveraging capacity and we've got some tools and we don't always need to be the problem solvers. Sometimes we just need to put a suggestion out there for people or a question out there or point them in the right direction to say, here's a group you could go to.
Definitely.
That concludes my brainstorming, but it was brilliant in my mind as I said it out loud.
But you could add WidbyTel. They have their own radio. They have their own TV station. Yeah. The newspapers have dead space that whenever they don't have ads, you can give them ready stock that they can put those ads in the paper. So whenever they have dead space, they'll carry your public messaging. I think together we're brilliant.
That was good. Those were good add-ons there. But again, trying to get the community thinking, I think most people are capable of figuring this out. You just don't think about it, right? Yeah. You're immersed in it and you don't take a step back to say, how could I do this different or better? And then when someone shows you or asks you a question, you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's a great way to braid that communications funding with FPHS. Yeah. The Bright by Text is a great example, like get the information to where people are in a convenient way. And those are all, we'll bring that as we move ahead with the communications piece, that'll be coming back through the board. But that's all that really lines up with staff level conversations on how we can be a bit more creative in our engagement, more proactive, and look at different mediums that we haven't been as involved with.
And putting some of those short videos on our website, that there are professionally prepared ones that are short. We don't have to make them all ourselves.
Right.
But that just say, for early childhood, for, with when you're in the sandwich, if you are concerned about end of life planning or trips and falls, that we develop some areas that just sit there and that content's already created. We just repurpose it and organize it in a way that makes sense for our community. Mm-hmm. Boy, I think that'd make a big difference too, because it's hard to find things on YouTube for me, at least. Yeah. I end up
watching a YouTube?
Okay. Exactly. I know more about makeup tutorials than you'd ever know. I mean, I can't find the information I need on that YouTube, but so you gotta pull it from there and put it someplace good. You can't expect people to go there. At least not on the senior side of the generation, which I'm now associating.
So,
is that in your AARP invitation yet?
I have it. Yes, thank you.
Just checking.
Uh-huh. Bob, would you like to save me from my...
Yeah, as you finally woke me up. I'm the oldest guy in the room. I know that for a fact. and the 17% higher in Island County, the median age, and it was brought up a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. We have a center in the center in Oak Harbor that used to have the name the Senior Center. And we had about 1,000 members before COVID. Unfortunately, it took our number down, but we'll be back to 1,000. And I'm only going to say that. I want to tell you, I think about 35% are not citizens of Oak Harbor, but enjoy the use of our center and certainly our members. And I've been to that center a number of times, and I am a member. I wanted to be member number 1,000, and we had a plan, and our director did, and then COVID hit. So I joined anyway, and they do some really cool things. They have a full kitchen in there, number one. And so they can prepare a lot of different things, or somebody else from outside comes and does that. And I guess one of the coolest things they do is right across the street is an elementary school, and they join with classes and the combination of the people at our center and those young people across the street, you know, is a really cool thing. The previous director was trying to talk me into building an entire campus because of the need for more of this, because a lot of us folks are getting older and are interested in the programs. Yeah. So anything that you can do to join with the center in Oak Harbor, I would recommend that you communicate with them, and you'll help us, and we can help you.
Great. Yeah, the center has been a key partner in the Senior Falls Coalition, so they're one of the members of that group, and they've been also a great community partner in planning health fairs and outreach events. We've hosted a few this past year there, and we're always looking for more ways to get involved with the center and the populations they serve. Thank you. The FPHS funding also, it actually pretty nearly covers our communicable disease program. There's some other state level funding. So it funds the work we do broadly in, you know, for tuberculosis prevention and management, other disease surveillance and outreach, immunization promotion or education, and sexually transmitted infection prevention work.
What's an enteric?
Like a gastrointestinal or, you know, stomach bug.
Okay.
Mm. Where do you spend most of your time? On which bullet point?
It can fluctuate. I'd say, you know, there's been a lot of time spent on respiratory viruses, especially this time of year. Our tuberculosis program, I think it'd be a great program to bring through Board of Health and take a deeper dive into that, because it's something that touches on some of our immigrant communities. And it is something that can take quite a bit of time if and when we have an active case that we're managing. And then we do a lot, you know, sexually transmitted infections are the most commonly reported communicable disease in the state. So we field a lot of questions related to that and support folks and try to do upstream prevention work. So this funding isn't just, you know, surveillance. Mm-hmm. It's also active measures, prevention, you know, serving as an infection prevention resource with our partners. And then FPHS funds a significant portion of environmental public health. So we have some funding that's supporting some of our food safety staff. We have funding that helps support our water resources planning and hydrogeology. Well, more the water resources planning. We have been looking at that funding that's allocated for a new position. And then there's new funding in this Amendment 15 that's specifically allocated for leadership and covering the manager position. And then we're using the funding for the SmartGov software permit manager. Also, some of the cross sector, like the work with the comp plan, zoonotic disease, covers quite a bit. right here. So yeah, some of the zoonotic disease prevention, the programs Chris presented on last Board of Health, a lot of that is FPHS, not the solid waste. We looked at that contract. And then the land use, water resources, zoonotic disease. I'm going to skip through this, but yeah, I think it would be, I think, a good Board of Health topic to bring the food safety program and take a deeper dive into the work going on there.
And then talk about why we can't do the letters or the happy faces. That'd be a good conversation for us.
That would be good history for me as well. We talked about the SmartCov coordination. And so these are some policy considerations. You know, a lot of this funding, we've been working to get our arms around, us and every other county. It's a great opportunity, but it's also a lot to integrate, you know, for health departments across the state. And we want to make, you know, make investments that are the highest use of this funding and work with our policymakers to ensure we're making the right investments and tracking and monitoring progress. And so these are some considerations, and essentially if there's board discussion around any of these items.
When we're developing our programs and services utilizing new funding, I know that we have robust internal department conversations, that there are unlimited ideas that come from the county commissioners, that we are idea people. We are. Do you talk with like healthcare industry, other municipalities? Like, I'm thinking what I see as needs may not be the same as what the city's experiencing as needs. What's our kind of vetting process to determine what kind of programs and services we need or positions we need with this new type of funding?
Yeah. As someone who was really involved with the initial allocation, you know, that's where we landed on that. We don't do a lot of our own primary data collection because it can be a little problematic and it's a big lift. But we did, the department did do a provider survey that defined providers really broadly, not just healthcare, childcare providers, you know, community centers thing. And so we did that data gathering exercise to identify priorities. And then we have a number of, you know, existing data sources that our epidemiology team works with, around like Medicaid access to services, and then the CHIP 2020 to look back at what were those community priorities that were identified. Because a lot of them, you know, we didn't fully get there just because we didn't have the investment available to do the work. So we look at a lot of different factors in addition to, you know, feedback from our policymakers.
So I just want to have on the table, and I don't know how, what I consider is a major threat, and that is the opioid issues and our youth. There was a presentation recently where I think the health officer from Wakayakum, Clark, Cowlitz, whatever, those four counties, and there's new data out that talks about the number of deaths due to fentanyl. And I don't know, and I hate to end your conversation on a downer, but the data is staggeringly terrifying, especially when you look at it around kids. And I don't know what that means. I know you get some prevention money. I don't know the answer. I know we talk about it at NACO. We talk about it at, I think you guys talk about it with SALFO some. I don't know what the answer is, but keeping... I know that while I'd like to stick my head in the sand, that's not the answer. And how do we get ahead of this? And how do we take advantage of the work you're doing here and the money coming? And I know you have a planning group through the BHO, ASO, but how do we start making sure we're weaving the work you're doing with that opioid money and the fact that this very real threat is stalking us.
Yeah.
I hate to be a Debbie Downer on this one, but
you're
I'm really
worried about getting that money to opioids. You're talking about really fentanyl, doing community outreach and education around fentanyl.
I probably am more concerned about the fentanyl. I'm concerned about all of it. And I know we have opiate money coming in,
But the data tells us that the more, and Taylor, if I'm wrong, you correct me. But the data coming in tells us we have a terrifying problem. And I heard a presentation at NACO where they're putting fentanyl on stickers and giving them away outside of schools in some parts of our country in order to solicit their next market base. And there is intentional and smart strategy around this being set up by I don't need to say anymore. I think I'm saying things that y'all are aware of. I just want to leverage your FPHS with this other stuff, knowing that I don't want to be one of those counties that is at the top of that, those statistics, that data mess.
There is an FPHS category and bucket for opioids. So Island County, we're not receiving, and I'm in conversation with Wisalfo to see how we can get on board with that in the future. And that could be a, you know, fund transfer over to human services, or we're certainly open to work collaboratively on data for us. Prevention.
So what does the coroner say is our data on that?
Well, and we also have, and I think that would be a great Board of Health topic with our human services epi, who she's really been looking at the data side of opioids and how we can use that position to better understand, you know, what's going on in our communities. There's a real data issue with opioids. You know, it's not a reportable, overdose is not reportable or notifiable. So we have a tracking issue around data, but we're looking at strategies for, you know, for of course, voluntary reporting, so we can understand what's happening in the community.
Even with Narcan, because we've moved it more and more into the community, over the counter, you can pick it up at your fire station. And so we're saving lives, we're reversing potential deaths, but we don't have data on that anymore because we're not using it in the same way. But I will never forget one of the base commanders when I was first elected talking about the recovery of his daughter and tearing up when he talked about his 2-year-old grandchild. You remember that, Bob? I saw you nod. It was at our Health Heroes event back when we used to do the Health Heroes stuff. And so, you know, we don't know the future of a life saved.
So we're interested in that.
Okay.
Also, are we doing Health Heroes, or are we done with that?
Health Heroes is not active currently.
Okay.
Come talk to us.
Yes. Well, that's a good segue. Invite Susan up to discuss. Well,
ending on a negative note.
Oh, I didn't know we had something on the back. I thought this was our last thing. Oh, Bob had a question.
So, Lee. To try to end on a little bit more positive note, you mentioned earlier that we're like number 4 in the county list.
I believe.
Who's number 1, 2, and 3? Do you know? Okay.
Our neighbor.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, that part of it is pretty cool. I sure understand. The last topic. Yeah. it's not funny, but I had a family member who used to snort oxycodone, and of course, that in my lifetime, that was one of the more terrible times, but you don't even hear oxycodone today. You know, it's all about fentanyl. And I get it. What little bit I understand about that. Thank God. My family member is not currently having a problem. But I just can't imagine. And some of this ad that I see on TV once in a while from these, what looks like in most cases, mothers, of people that were lost because of fentanyl. You know, one looks like a high school football player, and they show the pictures of those people that were lost. And I sure understand Commissioner St. Clair's concern for that. But I can tell you that you know, in my family, and just what little I know about this fentanyl thing, I mean, it's about as scary as can be. But for us to be the, you know, the fourth most healthy county, I mean, I'm kudos to everybody that's made that happen. So thank you.
I'll take credit personally, but it is a lot of longevity data. And and it's an interesting ranking that NACO does that looks at a lot of different social factors, but a lot of it is about around longevity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, that's a lot of good work.
Yeah.
Taylor?
Is it Taylor?
Taylor, I've got Taylor.
I thought we had Susan.
I don't care if we're doing Susan and Taylor or Taylor than Susan, but we're doing Susan and Taylor at some point.
I'm just lost.
Okay, Taylor, you're up.
Hi, thank you.
COVID Susan. Do we have the maybe I had it out of order on my
You're right. Here. I can boost it. Okay. Yeah, Taylor's first.
I was just seeing if any of Chab folks joined online today. See, Deborah is here today. I'm not gonna put you on the spot, Deborah, but we have a Chab member who's joining us today as well. But thank you all for welcoming us, Chab. I will be sitting in this position ideally every meeting moving forward, but welcoming Chab members to also join in to provide just updates on what Chab has been up to, next steps and ways that we would like to collaborate with Board of Health. So without further ado, we are in the process of a kickoff meeting for our CHAW. It's going to take place this Thursday with our partners that we are contracting with. They're the Ascendant Healthcare Partners. We're really looking forward to this. CHAB has been actively engaged in kind of orienting ourselves as well as community members to the CHAW process, the CHIP process, community health assessment, community health improvement plan for folks, and then just getting folks to the table and bringing the table to folks to know what was done in the past and where we would like to go in the future. And so this kickoff meeting is kind of the big step in defining the timeline for completion of the community health assessment and actively engaging public health leadership and CHAB in that process as our core team. We are excited to also be start digging into the comp plan support and learning just about what that process looks like. I think CHAB is really eager and interested to learn about what was done in the past in that realm of work, as well as ways that community will be engaged in the future. So that is something that we're hoping to bring feedback and updates back to Board of Health as well. And just in general for regular order of business, I suppose, is we're still recruiting, ongoing recruitment for CHAB. I'm happy to follow up. I just need to update our sector groups with the addition of two new members as of last month and a potential new member to come on board in the following months. But I think we have really great representation and active engagement in the group. I'm very excited about the work moving forward. My final update for CHAB is comes from a CHAB member actually presented during our last meeting. ITUA has a email list now for folks to sign up to receive updates on any kind of bed availability. So it's very current and up to date. Happy to share that email to get added to that list if folks are, and I can include it perhaps for the meeting minutes after this meeting.
Can I ask a question about that last one? It's more a question to my colleagues than to you. Having been to the ATUHA picnic, having paid attention to the need for detox, I'm wondering, as we look at our legislative agenda, if there's interest in advocating to move from a 10-bed to a 16-bed, if we can find the right funding. So you don't have to answer today. I just want to raise that in a public meeting that that's a question I've wondered about.
And you, and what brings it up for me is you said, what's our bed occupancy rate?
I think we, I think that it could be a good county priority. We talk with the city a little bit about it. I know I've been at a couple of city council meetings, and randomly, I too was come up at those meetings in public comment. So I think, and the public comment's not coming to us. So I think that it'd be good just to do some outreach to the city to understand community impact, and then bed utilization is important. And then I think if someone wants to pick it as their priority, that we put it on the list.
Okay. Who would you suggest, either to you or Mayor Severance, if I'm curious about this, who do you think is the right person to talk to?
So would that require a remodel?
Or yes.
It would. Okay.
Well, no, it would require, I don't know.
They've kind of just, we designed it to add on to, so we would just get, we would just have plans designed to add on to it and then construct more beds. I think it would just, I think what the piece we're not seeing, and maybe Human Services is seeing, is there was some community feedback about, because I say, well, there's been no complaints or impact to the neighborhood, because of course no one's come here to talk to us, right? And I haven't gotten any emails. I don't know that that's true on the city level. I think there has been some community feedback. It'd be good to understand what that is. And then also the ramifications of bed expansion. Does it get in more of our citizens? Does it serve more of the regional population? If it, the region does need beds, and I'm supportive of regional beds. But again, a lot of the community feedback is, well, what's the transportation of the individual back to their home community once they've received short-term treatment? I think we just need to understand how it's being used right now, how those additional beds would be used, what would be any community impact, both pro and con. And then again, I think understanding that regional relationship would be more important on bed expansion.
Yeah, and I know when it was built, I toured it with I think some of the commissioners that are here. So that I asked the question because it seemed like it was larger than 10 beds. But that's aside from that, I have not received a lot of input. Certainly not a lot of negative input, or I would have heard about it. I think there were, including our law enforcement, we were maybe more concerned about it than we needed to be in the beginning. So having said that, I think I would have heard if there were complaints, and I don't believe we've had too many. So
you raised for me a good question, is which reach out to someone like Chief Dresker, because it's a tool in the toolbox for our sheriff and your law enforcement to refer people into that facility when they're in crisis as well. It's voluntary. But I think for me, it's just a question. I raised it with Linda at one point in time, and it's been sort of circling around, but we're going to come into that season of our board life where we talk about legislative priorities, and it's a capital ask, and it aligns with the state priorities. So I just want to, I'll do some more questions, but I wanted to raise it in a chance when I had to talk to my colleagues, all three of you here, a little bit about that. Sorry for digressing.
Thank you for your time. And as always, feedback's welcome. So if there's anything you'd like for us to bring back as well from CHAB, please don't hesitate to reach out.
So one thing for the CHAB on the comp plan, because I know it's like, how, I think there might be. So today I had the conversation about population projection growth in Island County in that 20-year window. And the number is shocking. To me, it was shocking, right? So you know, the last written number I saw was like 82,000. I think we're at like maybe 87-ish thousand now. The projected number of individuals, not households that we'd have to build, but individuals who would be in Island County in 2022 is 100, or 20 years from now, is 102,000 people, right?
That's the moderate assessment.
That's the moderate assessment, right. So we would, that's a growth of like 15,000 people, 15 to 20,000 people. You think about how do you put that many more people on our island ecosystem where we have living wage jobs and where we have childcare and where we have, you know, equity to open space and healthy environments.
And that is that lens that CHAB can look at, which is how do you support 20,000 more people? Mm-hmm. I'm saying that for drama, but that's it, 15 sounds less dramatic, but it's still dramatic. 1,000 more people in Island County on these two islands in a way that preserves and enhances our health and quality of life, right? What does that look like? How can we use that health lens to say, if we're going to do that, this is the trail system we need to preserve. And this is the air quality that we want to see. And this is the access to providers that we're going to need. Do we have an adequate number for this population growth? I mean, when you really start thinking about what does that mean? Mm-hmm. What are we going to need to support that? That's really some of that work that the CHAB can do as it relates to that comp plan, is looking at our land use design and making sure that our land use can accommodate a healthy population, right? We can accommodate the people. I mean, certainly we could put people in high rises throughout the county, you know, and just call it all Oak Harbor. You have to do it. So, but at some point that's not healthy, right? That's not good quality of life. How much open space do we recommend per 1,000 people, right? That's information that can get researched and provided to all the municipalities so that everybody's thinking through, do I have enough expansion area to accommodate enough open space, right? Are we as a county saying, yes, you need this because you need this much open space to support this type of population? And those kind of recommendations, I think, are kind of what we need the CHAB to start thinking about, because that's a lot of new people to keep healthy in our community and on our island ecosystem.
And at a time when, to your one or two slides, we're seeing seawater intrusion into our water systems. We're seeing some of those things. So there's a good nexus there.
It's a great point. Yeah, I think even just hearing that figure out loud really gets gears rolling, right? And you're thinking about not just short-term solutions to huge problems, but really having to think long down the road. And I think I would bet our community, once they hear that, will really have great ideas and probably already thinking about it without knowing that number. But wow, that's great.
Yeah, it set me back. I mean, I literally was like, oh mm-hmm. right? I don't know how many people I thought were coming, like 3,000. I could handle that. But this is a lifestyle change, right? And how do you plan for that? And how do you do it in a healthy way that preserves what we love, but recognizes the fact that we change? And then again, you know, ensuring that we don't design in health inequities.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say one final thing on Commissioner St. Clair talked about water. I looked at a list today of over 500 new homes that are being planned around Oak Harbor. It was probably more like 700, the list. Mm-hmm. And we haven't had a lot of building. We haven't had a lot of development in my entire 8 years. But we've got a number coming. And we have enough good water for those folks. I wonder about the rest of the county and the water. I think some of the water systems are poor. I happen to know that because I own a little place out by Coronet Bay, and they've got the goofiest water system I've ever seen. So I think that if the county, I don't know, you know, the state tries to step in and be in charge of our water, but quite frankly, they don't do any kind of a good job, even close. And I think that the county, if the county can more consistently and more carefully look at the water system for any new home, where are they getting their water, and is it a certified system, and who's the manager? Because I can't imagine. I understand that the company King Water has sold and is owned by a more larger corporate, which I believe is going to happen more and more. I mean, if you can control somebody's water, you've got them. So
Bob, in the 500 to 700, is that within the UGA or around Oak Harbor?
It's in the city.
Interesting.
In the city. And you know, a couple of that property that Waldron used to own 135 homes.
Yeah, I remember that.
Guy in the hills talking 190.
Not counting those, right? Because you have to actually move the equipment to build the house.
Don't I forgot how many people are watching this meeting or listening. So I wouldn't have said a couple of things, but yeah, it's a number, and it's, you know, I know some of those. We got about 75 that just have finally gotten their permits or are very, very close. So we're going to see quite a bit of building in Oak Harbor.
But then I start getting more and more worried about access off the island in case of an emergency.
Oh, I don't blame you. Yeah. I cross my fingers every time I go over the bridge.
It's helpful to know what's inside the UGA and your water system, and what's outside is, I think about that. I do know when you asked about Cornet Bay and those other questions, I've been asking some of those questions as we look at unprecedented dollars coming in. I want to make sure that it doesn't abandon rural counties. Jen may talk with the two of you about whether to bring Helen Price Johnson and talk about USDA resources that can help with water systems. They will provide supports to that. And I have a meeting coming up with Craft 3 to talk about water and septic and what resources they have available. I think you or Heather or both of you are participating in that. So I have some of the same questions.
The data side too, that's a primary goal of our hydrogeology program, to take a comprehensive look at, you know, well data, rainfall data, and seawater, sea level rise and intrusion. So that, I think that's a program that it would be helpful to bring back through Board of Health.
Yeah. As well. Thanks for raising that.
Thank you. This is good information. Susan.
Just sitting that long.
Before Susan dives in. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to, she said, I'm not used to sitting that long. And people always ask me the number one qualification to be a county commissioner. What do you have to know to do your job? Which, I mean, obviously not a lot. But I say the number one qualification is you have to be able to sit for an obnoxiously long period of time. If you are not capable of sitting for a good 6 hours, this is not the job for you.
And get a good chiropractor.
Before Susan dives into this COVID-19 update, I do want to acknowledge that this will be Susan's last Board of Health with us. She's retiring. And Susan has been with the county, I think, over 30 years.
Since May of 1991.
Wow.
Gosh, yeah.
She's tried that before, and we just say no.
Say no.
Haven't tried?
Retiring?
I failed retirement, so I can say, you know, it's really a ricochet thing.
Yeah,
so.
We think you can take a couple months off and then
we'll be a sandwich generation.
We'll see you soon.
Be a what?
Yeah, for a while.
Generation. That's where I am.
Well, thank you for all your service. That's a gift to the county. That's a long time.
Thank you. And, you know, it's been a real honor to work here. And, you know, I think the best thing about here, I hate to channel Keith here, is the people that I've worked with. You know, none of us can do it alone, you know, and the collective brain here is amazing. You know, when you don't know something, you know, if you root around and ask, you can always find out what you need to know. There's somebody here that has some little pearl of knowledge that solves your immediate problems. So it's always been, I've always enjoyed working here through everything.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Best work.
So I'm Susan Wagner, and I'm the COVID-19 response supervisor. And Sean asked me to come here to talk to you a little bit about community rates right now, hospitalization, that there was a concern. And then we're also going to just briefly discuss the new vaccines. So we made this PowerPoint September 14th. And it got submitted. So a few things have changed since then, and I'll point that out as I go along. So we're going to talk about community transmission, wastewater, and hospital data to just talk about trends in the community right now. So this first slide is community transmission, and I just must give
credit to Jamie Hamilton. This is his work. So community transmission, this particular slide shows lab specimens. So these would be the folks that encounter a healthcare provider at some point. They have a test and it gets reported into our Washington disease reporting system. This does not include any home tests at all because there is no reporting mechanism for home tests. And that's the majority of what people are utilizing now. So if you look at this, you can see some little humps and bumps. The blue data is the day-to-day reporting. The yellow line is the trends. So you can see there's been a big hump last October. There was a big hump December, January. A lot of that was driven by outbreaks in long-term care facilities. Mm-hmm. Nobody was very sick, but there was a lot of positive cases. Same thing, March, April, a little humpy bumpies. And now you can see that in August and September, there is an upswing. Our transmission rate is considered moderate right now, and we have the most cases since spring. So if you pay a little attention to where our bumps are in March, June, and now, we can move on to the wastewater data. So the wastewater-based epidemiology is collecting wastewater a couple times a week, and it gets sent off to the public health lab, and they analyze for the amount of COVID DNA. This in no way translates to actual number of cases. The science is not that well developed, but definitely shows trends. We're collecting at two sites in Island County, Oak Harbor and Coopville, because that's how many we are allowed right now. That may expand in the future, but it's interesting because it shows somewhat the same peaks and valleys that the lab test does. The scale's different, so it looks a little different, but cases are definitely increasing right now. So you can move along. But the good news is that hospital rates really are not increasing. So this slide is a week old. It's from the Northwest Healthcare Response Network. And these are the folks that work really hard and monitor all of the bed data in the state of Washington. So we decided that we would show just the central and the north district. The central district is Pierce County and King County. So those are our population centers in the state of Washington. You know, if you're really, really sick and you have to go to Harborview, you're going to show up in this data. The North District is Snohomish. I can't do without counting on my fingers here. It's Snohomish, Skagit, Whatcom Island, and San Juan. So last week, the Central District was showing kind of a modest decline. I clearly needed glasses. And we were showing a modest upswing. This week, the Central District for hospitalized COVID patients went from 158 to 177. So that's a greater number. But I mean, how many people live in that area? 2 million? Quite a few. So that's a modest upswing, but nevertheless an upswing.
2 million, you said quite a few. That was your official public health answer. Was
that's right.
Quite a few.
Yeah.
Super accurate.
Super accurate.
That's what happens when you move up, you know, you just become a trends guy, not a numbers guy. Yeah. But in our North District, our hospitalized patients for COVID went from 50 to 40. So, you know, that's
good.
Good.
Yep.
So, you know, one thing that's been going on since the beginning of the pandemic and probably before, the number of hospital beds are actually available for people that are sick. If you look up there in the Central District, which is King and Pierce County, there's only 13 ICU beds. It's not very many, not very many acute beds, 50. And so this has been a struggle that hospitals have been dealing with for a very long time. It's stressing the system. It's for a variety of reasons. If you look down in the North District, just that first column, we have 16 ICU beds. So our North County regions that have many less people have more beds. So We always have to, I think, in our hearts, give a big thank you to the folks at the Northwest Regional Healthcare Network, because they manage this. You know, if you need a bed, this is who you call. And they shuffle people around according to their needs. And sometimes there's a bit of a wait, but they work really, really hard to make sure that everybody gets the health care that they need. So I don't know if you guys have any questions on hospitalizations.
I just had one question on the water. When I saw this somewhere, I don't know where I saw this.
Which one?
The water-based epidemiology. Because the community transmission, I feel like, is half the story. Because you, like you said, you don't have any of the home-based kits. People test, they stay home, they take care of themselves. We never know about that. But in this water-based epidemiology, in my, you know, trying to make sense of the data, I look at, oh, look, we had an increase of Memorial Day in our summer months around Labor Day. And it's not just measuring the residents of Island County, it's measuring all the tourists and visitors and people we have. Am I making up my own facts to suit my narrative?
I can't enough. Answer that question. We also monitor, we get the data from Stanley, just because we figure,
why not?
It's there. Why not?
Well, when Josephine has an outbreak, we have an outbreak on Camino.
Mm-hmm.
So fair enough.
So.
Just curious. I like to make up facts to fit my story. And this was one where I thought my narrative was, this isn't just our residents, this is visitors to our islands as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I said, the scale is different. So
yeah.
They're often what maybe looks very large in August.
I did have somebody call me and say, oh my gosh, I do feel like sometimes the number of times we're all going to die happens. And I said, we're in an endemic. And they said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, sent them our website of what you do, all of the public health guidelines. Mm-hmm. And no, I do not have the power to declare a state of emergency nor order some of those interventions. But fair enough, you know, underlying that is people's fear, and that's fair. But my understanding is these rates say do the right thing and continue to do the right things, as you guys already have on your website.
That is absolutely correct. If, you know, the trend says that cases are increasing, then we have that. We should provide that knowledge to the public so they can take precautions as they feel is necessary. And, you know, one other positive thing about wastewater-based epidemiology is that they will be adding analytics for RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, and flu. So they're starting to make that transition right now. So that data will be very helpful also.
But to your point about people being afraid, we have tools now that we didn't have when this pandemic first came out. You can get a vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So
you can get a mask.
I mean, we have tools now that are allowing us to stay a little safer in the environment.
And
if you're frightened, stay home until the rates drop again, or take some of these other precautions. You have control over your life. It's a locus of control thing. You don't have to go to the fair or to your favorite crowded restaurant or whatever your thing to do. If you're uncertain about your safety, it's good to self-isolate.
Yeah. Or you can wear a mask.
I know.
Yeah.
I will say on our website, there's different steps you can take based on community level and around, you know, masking or staying, you know, those types of recommendations. It shifts based on the activity that folks might want to take.
So did I hear you say that you're going to talk about the most recent vaccine? Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to say. Yeah. Good job.
So we're making the transition right now to an updated 2023-2024 COVID-19 vaccine. This is a rapidly changing situation right now, not in a bad way. We are just transitioning from the now deauthorized bivalent vaccine to the updated 2023-2024 COVID-19 vaccine. So as of September 11th, I don't know why they picked that date, but they did, to transition from the United States government supplying all COVID-19 vaccines at no cost. That's ending. Now COVID-19 vaccines are in a commercial phase, like most other vaccines, meaning that the providers buy them and then they bill insurance companies for them. So that's the simplified version. There's lots of devils in the details there. But the FDA and the CDC have both approved the COVID-19 vaccines. The deauthorization of the bivalent vaccine also occurred on November 11th. That means all of the U.S. government supplied vaccine is no longer authorized for use in the United States. So along with that, anybody who had the old COVID-19 vaccine, it's not approved for use, so we had to waste it. So it all had to be properly disposed of. We have done that from our depot in Island County. It was kind of sad to watch all of that vaccine go away. It was also an indicator that we, for the last year, we've had enough in Island County so that we could supply providers wanted it, we'd run it over there. And we'll probably be closing our depot in the near future. We now, as this moment in time, the only authorized vaccine that we are storing and distributing, if anybody wants it, is Novavax. And we have 25 doses. And so that's still there. That one's still authorized. So next slide. So COVID-19, what do we know? We know that it's coming soon. There's a possibility that there's 12 vaccines of the new updated vaccine in the county right now. Most people are expecting it to get it on starting Friday. So I went and got my RSV and flu vaccine last week. So I asked the gal at Walgreens, well, when are you getting your the new COVID vaccine? And she says, you know, we're not really sure. It'll just show up on the truck. So if you're interested in getting one, the best thing to do is just monitor their websites and make an appointment. It's probably like it's been all along. Initially, vaccines will be a little bit in short supply, but as we move through time, the supply chain will improve. There will be more and more available. So
are they going to age restrict it like we've done in the past? Like the first tranche will be for 65 and above or something like that?
Haven't heard a thing about that. So
I'm not 65, so that wasn't a self-interested question.
Right.
Well, I am, and I haven't heard either, so.
What did he say?
Right.
No, there will not be any restrictions like that.
Okay.
Thank you, Howard.
I am worried about my mom, and I want to figure out a way to push her to the front of the line, but I guess there's not really a good way to do that.
Well, monitor the websites and get her an appointment as soon as you can. So as we know more, we will post that.
Okay.
My son and daughter-in-law in Woodinville got theirs today.
Oh, good. Thanks, Howard. I'll move to Woodinville. Or no, I don't have to move.
Day trip.
Yeah. Where's your mom live?
Yeah. But during the pandemic, because it was a scary time when we were doing a lot of her health care, she came up and stayed with me. So I have health care providers for her up on my neck of the woods as well as down there, because sometimes this stuff gets confusing. Speaking of the sandwich generation.
Yes. So the short version of who gets what is everyone 6 months and older is eligible to receive an updated 2023-2024 COVID-19 vaccine. So little people, children 6 months to four, they'll need between one and three updated 2023-2024 COVID-19 vaccines, depending on their current vaccine status, what they've already had, and the manufacturer. Any person between a five and older, they'll get one 2023-2024 updated COVID-19 vaccines, depending on their vaccine status and the manufacturer.
How long do these last? And either you or, I mean, how are these now annual vaccines like my flu vaccine, or are these biannual like we were with the previous COVID vaccines?
Probably annual. You know, we think about this quite a bit like the annual flu vaccine, where flu shifts every year and COVID continues to mutate. I mean, virtually everybody has some level of immunity between natural infection and prior vaccination. So it's really about refreshing that immunity and really focusing on our most at-risk populations. I mean, that's the main goal, like for older adults, people with weakened immune systems.
Will you be monitoring any of our homebound and other populations where we stepped into the gap?
So generally what we've done is when we have screened folks that may need to have a homebound vaccination because they truly can't out.
Yeah,
so we have partnered with Island Drug. So we screen them through and then refer them on to Island Drug. He's been a great partner for going out and vaccinating our homebound.
Excellent.
People.
Yeah. And what do you do for South Whidbey and the other side of the moat?
They have been real active in the whole county. So
perfect.
They have a pharmacy in O'Connor, and they have one on the south end.
Oh, that's right.
You know, and haven't been a lot of people that truly need that they can't get out of their home.
I know.
For some folks, it's a convenience, but we try to help them through, you know, and screen that out so that Island Drug doesn't get overwhelmed, because it is a big community service that they're offering.
It should be a small numbers.
Yes. So anyway, back to our little talk. So anyone 5 and older, they get 1, 20, 23, 20, 24 COVID-19 vaccine, regardless of their previous vaccination status. And at least 2 months have passed since any previous COVID-19 vaccination. And I'm sorry, but I didn't finish the answer to your question. For our long-term care and our adult family homes, we are making sure that they are moving forward to get the vaccines for their population. So a lot of times they have a national pharmacy program. They have nurses there. So, you know, since all of this is changing, they are definitely on our radar screen because they are our vulnerable citizens and it's community living. They live together. So their chances, if one person gets sick, then it spreads throughout their community. And if people are sick and they're in long-term care, it's really not good for them to have to be isolated for 10 days in their room. It's hard on them and it's hard on the staff. And it's not where anybody wants to be.
The time check. So
yeah,
I think well, 2 of us have 3 o'clock.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
So we'll call it there. But there's up-to-date info on our website for additional resources.
Okay. Thank you.
Okie doke. Thank you.
Well, Susan, again, thank you for all the time and talent you've lent to Island County over the years. You will be very missed, and we'll wait for you to come back from this little retirement experiment.
Yeah. Have fun on retirement. We'll see you in a few months.
Probably.
We don't mind at all.
Yeah.
John, do you have anything?
Probably
more
during dark season. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody have anything else?
No,
I did not manage the time well, so I apologize to both of you for rushing at the end. But we can adjourn.
Thank you.
You?
Of course.